Penguin Random House Audio presents The Money Kings, the epic story of the Jewish immigrants who transformed Wall Street and shaped modern America, by Daniel Shulman, read for you by Jonathan Davis. For Stacy, Wesley, and Reed, and in memory of Bernard Shulman, 1930 to 2022. Preface. A debt. On my 30th birthday, my dad and I drove the 6 miles from his apartment on New York's Upper East Side to Williamsburg, where he grew up until middle school, before his family moved across the borough to Bensonhurst. His old neighborhood was just 20 minutes away, but he measured the distance in decades. "I spent half my life trying to get out of Brooklyn," he joked. "Why go back now?" We ate lunch at Peter Luger, the iconic steakhouse, situated in the shadow of the Williamsburg Bridge. Founded in 1887, it was once a mecca for local power brokers. This was Dad's first visit. His parents kept a kosher household, and besides, money was tight. Afterward, I suggested we try to locate his childhood home, a 5-story brick tenement on McKibben Street, where his family had lived in a 2-bedroom apartment on the 3rd floor. He and his 2 brothers had occupied 1 small room, their parents the other. My father, the youngest in their family of 5, recalled often sleeping on the living room couch to escape the claustrophobic twin bed he shared with his middle brother Marvin. So many of his most vivid memories were rooted on McKibben Street. The transcendent aroma of his mother's gribiness, the Jewish delicacy of fried onions and chicken skins, the sound of the iceman clomping up the stairs to make his deliveries, the soothing breeze on the rooftop on sweltering summer nights, the sweet sting of a broom handle connecting with a spalldeen during neighborhood stickball games. The apartment also conjured bitter recollections of a short-tempered and abusive father who imposed order with his belt strap and his fists, and eventually left their family for a mistress, and of the fear, anger, and uncertainty that followed. Dad gazed out the window as we passed the boutiques and bars of Bedford Avenue, as if he were studying a Martian landscape. These were not the gritty streets of his Depression-era youth. Finally, we turned onto his old block, a shabby and graffiti-covered one-way street off Bushwick Avenue. The building, we discovered, had been demolished. The area was at once vastly different and surprisingly recognizable. It remained a neighborhood of immigrants. But where Yiddish had once been spoken, now Spanish was. We parked and walked around, my dad pointing out the landmarks he remembered. P.S. 147, where he attended elementary school. The squat brick library down the street. "We lived almost like we were in Europe," he remarked, explaining that, when he was coming up, each of the surrounding streets might as well have been separate countries. "The Italians were on the next block," he said, pointing. "The Roma lived in the storefronts. Jews, his people, resided on McKibben Street. The wealthy and assimilated German Jews who lived uptown in Manhattan called his people Ostjuden, Eastern Jews. They were the persecuted and impoverished immigrants from what is today Hungary, Poland, Russia, and Ukraine, who during the late 19th and early 20th centuries spilled off steamships in New York Harbor by the hundreds and scattered to the Lower East Side, Williamsburg, and other Jewish enclaves, packing into tenements like the one on McKibben. My grandmother, Lena, immigrated to New York in the early 1900s from Paramushlana, a town in what is today western Ukraine, and was then part of the domain of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. She was 8 years old and traveled alone, wearing a sign around her neck so an uncle she had never met would recognize her when she disembarked, or so the story goes in my family. My grandfather, Elias, Al, everyone called him, also came to New York as a child, departing from the port city of Libau, in present-day Latvia, with his parents and siblings in the fall of 1905, during a spasm of anti-Jewish violence in the Pale of Settlement, the territory on the western fringe of the Russian Empire, where the Tsar permitted Jews to live. Lena was a candy dipper for a Manhattan confectioner. Al, a neighborhood tough guy, worked as a chauffeur, salesman, and mover. Through his contacts in the local Democratic Party machine, he eventually landed a patronage job with the Internal Revenue Service. They lived a world apart from the protagonists of this book, who moved in rarefied circles and resided in palatial Manhattan mansions containing Baroque masterworks worth more than Al and Lena could have hoped to earn in several lifetimes. Yet their two worlds were inextricably and at times uncomfortably tethered, bound by their common religion and by the proud yet sorrowful history of struggle and displacement the Jewish people shared. My grandparents would have been familiar with Jacob Schiff, the investment banking mogul who bridged both spheres. Perhaps they first heard his name mentioned reverentially by a fellow immigrant who had coal in his furnace or a job, or had learned English thanks to one of the many social welfare programs supported by Unser Yankele, our little Jacob. Or maybe they overheard a Zionist denounce the financier, incensed by Schiff's contention that establishing a Jewish homeland risked transgressing their American patriotism. But during Al and Lena's formative years, Schiff was ever present. He was the self-appointed leader of American Jewry, presiding benevolently, if paternalistically, over the immigrant masses. On Wall Street, his only equal was the fearsome John Pierpont Morgan. Schiff used his fortune unreservedly to ensure a future for the Jews at a time when their long-term existence seemed very much in doubt. During the prelude to World War I, as conditions in Eastern Europe and Russia worsened and cablegrams reporting massacres and mob violence piled up, Schiff worked to ensure that the United States remained a refuge for immigrants. This was no simple task. The fractious immigration debates of that era were strikingly like those of today. Politicians called for harsh restrictions and stoked fears of disease-carrying foreign criminals invading the United States, degenerating the country's character, and becoming public charges. The nation's doors constantly seemed on the verge of slamming closed to immigrants. Eventually, and with tragic consequences, they did shut. During Schiff's lifetime, he and members of other wealthy German-Jewish banking clans successfully mobilized against efforts to curb Jewish immigration. Between 1890 and 1920, the year Schiff was most active, the Jewish population of the United States swelled from 400,000 to 3.4 million. Jewish philanthropists, with Schiff at their vanguard, founded and sustained a head-spinning network of organizations and social programs, from schools and hospitals to orphanages and job training centers, to assist the new arrivals and speed their acculturation. Banding together, not always harmoniously, Schiff and his fellow communal leaders formed what amounted to the first American Jewish lobby, forcefully advocating for the rights of Jews abroad and pressing for liberal immigration policies at home. Al and Lena and their sons, my father and his brothers, owed more to Schiff and his allies than they might have realized. Absent the advocacy and philanthropy undertaken by Schiff and his friends, their American story, and mine, might not have been possible. Millions of American Jews, descendants of the Russian and Eastern European immigrants who sought and found opportunity in the United States at the turn of the century, owe a similar debt. This is a book about the evolution of modern finance, about Wall Street pioneers who formed towering institutions such as Goldman Sachs, Kuhn Loeb, and Lehman Brothers, and who shaped, to an astonishing degree, the world we live in today. It is also a tale of how immigrants such as Al and Lena arrived in this country and why they thrived. These seemingly disparate threads overlap, forming part of the same remarkable story. Introduction. Salem Fields. September 28, 1920 was supposed to be a joyful day. A Tuesday, it fell during
Sample complete. Ready to continue?